We are starting lesson 4 of our Galatians class this morning. Lesson 4, this is Galatians chapter 2. In this chapter, Paul is continuing the argument that was in chapter 1, how his gospel was not derived from any earthly source. We already saw in the last lesson that it was not designed to please men. It was not something that people were going to necessarily applaud him for or an easy message to listen to. And it was also not something that came from Jerusalem or the Judean churches. And this is important because the Judaizers were trying to claim that they were on the same side as Paul. But Paul was only giving the Gentiles the easy version of the law, and they were coming to fill in the gaps. Filling in the gaps, of course, with Jewish law, with their own twisted form of Judaism that bound the Gentiles to things that they did not really actually have to be a part of or to be responsible for. This chapter, Paul is continuing this idea some more about not being bound or not deriving authority from Jerusalem. He goes more into the influential brethren in Jerusalem, and then specifically Peter himself. And there's a very important reason why he has to talk about Peter all by himself, even though Peter's included in a lot of this already. So let's start by reading chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. Then after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me. I went up because of a revelation and set before them, though privately before those who seemed influential, the gospel that I proclaim among the Gentiles, in order to make sure I was not running or had not run in vain. But even Titus, who was with me, was not forced to be circumcised, though he was a Greek. Yet because of false brothers secretly brought in, who slipped in to spy out our freedom that we have in Christ Jesus, so that they might bring us into slavery, to them we did not yield in submission even for a moment, so that the truth of the gospel might be preserved for you. And from those who seemed to be influential, what they were makes no difference to me, God shows no partiality. Those, I say, who seemed influential added nothing to me. On the contrary, when they saw that I had been entrusted with the gospel to the uncircumcised, just as Peter had been entrusted with the gospel to the circumcised, for he who worked through Peter for his apostolic ministry to the circumcised worked also through me for mine to the Gentiles. And when James and Cephas and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given to me, they gave the right hand of fellowship to Barnabas and me that we should go to the Gentiles, and they to the circumcised. Only they asked us to remember the poor, the very thing I was eager to do. So the story of Paul's life as a Christian is continued. Remember, he gave kind of an autobiographical summation of his life for the purpose of showing that after he was converted, he did not run to Jerusalem to report to the Jewish leaders there or to report to the apostles there. He went and preached in different areas. He had already made one very quick trip to Jerusalem where he saw Peter and James briefly. Well, now he adds in another visit that's very important for us to identify here because it's not so much what happened in this visit, it's what didn't happen in this visit that's very important for Paul's argument. So this is 14 years after his conversion, where he goes back to Jerusalem and he takes along with him Barnabas and Titus. They had been traveling with him. They were good companions, faithful brethren. Barnabas was an excellent choice to have along with you when you are preaching and trying to teach people the gospel. Remember that his name did not start out as Barnabas. He was literally renamed to honor his ability to encourage brethren and to heal wounds. So if there's any kind of division between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians, Barnabas is the kind of person that you want in the room. He has the right things to say. He knows how to mend fences. He is very effective at this sort of thing. Titus is another interesting choice. because he's a Gentile. So Paul's a Jew, Barnabas is a Jew. They don't have any problem with Gentiles. They're preaching of Gentiles just fine. But it's helpful to also actually bring along a Gentile to show what that looks like in action. So Paul and Barnabas and the others with them are teaching Gentiles that you can be Christians too, and you have to turn away from paganism, turn away from all of these different sins. And this isn't just a case of the righteous Jews coming to bring the gospel to the wicked Gentiles. They have Titus there with them to show an example of what this actually looks like. Titus was an early convert of Paul's, and so they got to see this for themselves, somebody who had turned away from those things and had been living a faithful life for some time. But we're not actually talking about a visit to a Gentile city. I mean, that's what they'd been doing for some time. But what Paul is referring to here is when they went back to Jerusalem. And what were Barnabas and Titus good for there? Well, the purpose of this trip was to meet with the so-called pillars of Jerusalem. Paul makes a point to say, you know, he kind of hedges that phrase with things like, you know, they seemed to be pillars, or the brethren who seemed to be influential. And I don't think that that's casting doubt on their influence, that Paul's trying to belittle them in any way. Only he's acknowledging that they are influential, that they are important, but that they aren't necessarily, you know, that it is, you know, they are not like pseudo-popes or anything like that, that they don't have some grand official title within the church. They're apostles. They are some of the earliest teachers and leaders of the church, but he is also not reporting to them. He's not having to answer to them for what he is teaching or getting instructions from them. They're influential where they are, but as for Paul's work, they don't have any particular oversight or any say over what Paul is doing. Yet they are meeting, and there is a purpose to them meeting. We'll talk some about what they were discussing in a moment, but first we need to talk about something that they didn't discuss, something that did not come up in conversation, and that's the state of Titus. Titus was a Gentile. He was, he's called a Greek here. He had not been circumcised. He didn't have the Jewish background that so many of course, the Christians in Jerusalem did, and even Paul and Barnabas. Yet when they met with the pillars in Jerusalem, nobody objected to Titus being there in an uncircumcised state. Nobody said, hey, he needs to be circumcised. If you're going to take him around showing the Gentiles what it means to be a Christian and teaching them that they need to be converted, then you can't leave out this very important thing. We must circumcise him so that he can be right with God. That never came up in conversation at all. That would be very strange if circumcision were required for the Gentiles. We might imagine that maybe one apostle, one person, could have a moment of weakness. We'll talk about a different moment of weakness one had just a little later in this chapter. But when you have three of them there, a part of this meeting, it stretches beyond belief the idea that all of them were too cowardly or too ignorant to bring up this extremely important and basic part of being a faithful Jew. The only thing that we can understand from this is that it wasn't actually important, that the Gentiles did not need to do this, and so they did not force Titus to be circumcised. And that's a big part of why Paul brings this up. He said, the Judaizers are trying to make so much out of me going to Jerusalem a couple times, believing that I'm reporting to the apostles there or that I'm getting my instructions. that's the furthest thing from the truth. But let's talk about something in that visit. Why didn't they want Titus to be circumcised? If that's so important for the Gentiles, why would they refuse to force him to do so? It's a good argument. And it becomes something that the Judaizers can't answer, along with the rest of what Paul is arguing. Jim? Nope. You look like you're raising your hand. Sorry. Comments so far. Mike? Right.
And then you go 13, 14, then they have the Judaizers at the end of 14, that's why they're going to Jerusalem.
Right.
That's when we see this common language there, the pillars of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
That's the first time we see that, because they were the established teachers for that time.
Yes.
For the gospel. So is this where this fits in without mentioning time?
Okay, so that's a very good question, and the answer to it's a lot more complicated than it seems like it should be. I believe that this is the visit that's referred to at the end of chapter 11 and also again in chapter 12, not necessarily the one in chapter 15. And not everybody thinks that. There are a lot of people who think that this visit that Paul is talking about is the one in chapter 15 where they had a big public gathering talking about this issue of the Judaizing teachers and trying to settle once and for all what needed to be done. I don't think we're quite there yet, and there's a really important reason why that is most likely not the case. The Judaizers were arguing that Paul was making these trips to Jerusalem to report to the apostles or to report to Jewish leaders and getting instructions from them. Paul is going through from the history, you know, from his point of conversion on, and describing every time that he went to Jerusalem so that he can basically answer, okay, the first time I went, I was only there very briefly. I spoke to Peter, I saw James, but those were the only ones that I even saw. And that was, you know, what, 3 years after I was converted. So there wasn't a problem there. Then he's going down the line. The next visit was 14 years after I was converted, and this was a very important visit. This is one where we needed to address this issue of the Judaizing teachers. And so there's a common theme with the meeting in chapter 15, but chronologically it doesn't quite fit yet. Chronologically, there's another visit described in Acts where they go in chapter 11 and chapter 12. Now in Acts, almost nothing is said about that visit, just that they went. And so it is kind of hard to connect the dots. But if Paul were writing here in Galatians trying to argue that he did not get his orders from Jerusalem, and he completely left out one of the big times that he went to Jerusalem, that would be a huge gaping hole in his argument where they could say, okay, you address the others, but what about this one visit? What about this one time that you went and you saw the pillars of the church? And so I think it's a lot more logical to believe that Paul is going down the line chronologically, explaining each time that he went to Jerusalem and what he was doing there. And then we just haven't gotten to chapter 15 yet. I think the most logical thing is that the events of Acts 15 happened after Galatians was written, that we haven't actually gotten there at this point in history yet. And that still works. That still makes sense. For an issue that is this large and this problematic, it would be very simplistic to believe that there only has to be one discussion about it, and it's settled forevermore. When do people actually work like that? Think of every controversial thing in the history of a church. Has there ever been a time that there could be one discussion and then everybody's happy? And Acts 15 didn't do that either. It's not that everyone was happy, but the point being is that they were addressing it by trying to teach the Gentiles in these Gentile churches first, And then they realized, hey, this problem is continuing to expand. And so we have what's described in chapters 11 and 12, what Paul's talking about here, where he went to Jerusalem and he's talking to Peter, James, and John about this, where they are all concerned about the teaching of the Judaizers. And so they're discussing the problems there, and they're trying to help sort out what they need to do to keep everyone on the right track. Well, the problem continued to grow, and this is what this whole book is about, this whole letter, trying to convince the Gentiles that they should not listen to the Judaizers. But the problem continued to grow after this, and so they ended up with a big public gathering in Acts 15, even after this, where it was open to everybody, and they were discussing in great detail, looking from the Old Testament, looking from what Jesus had told them, Peter giving his testimony to the vision that he saw before he went to Cornelius, all these different things together where they could make very public, very widely known that the church in Jerusalem does not support these Judaizing teachers. The apostles do not agree with the false doctrine that is being spread. Listen to them at your own peril. You just do what you need to do to stay faithful to God, and you can safely ignore Judaism. So I don't have any problem believing, but this, as thorny as this issue was, and it took a long time to handle. And Acts 15 probably wasn't the end of it. I'm sure there were times after that where they still had to address it with different people, different churches, different false teachers that had to be exposed. But Acts 15 is kind of the culmination of that on the larger scale. Okay, so that's my take on the timeline here. I think it makes the most sense without leaving a hole in Paul's argument, and just kind of knowing what we know about human nature, how things escalate like that. I think we haven't gotten to Acts 15 yet here in Galatians. Okay, Jim? Oh, of course.
The law,
yes.
Liberty, circumcision, uncircumcision, Jew, non-Jew, and that's going away. So it's an interesting observation. But they knew after 14 years.
Yeah. These kinds of things tend to get all spooled up into weird and thorny arguments. But the Judaizing teachers were very persistent with trying to bind the Gentiles to their own traditions and their own patterns. And I think some of these Gentiles, they were confused. They were afraid. Did Paul forget to tell us something? I mean, put yourself in their shoes. You've been a Christian for a little while, and then suddenly someone tells you, oh, by the way, there's this whole other side to being a Christian that you don't know anything about, and you haven't been doing, so you've still been living in sin the entire time that you've been a Christian, and you need to start following all these other rules. Like that, you know, if you're relatively new in the faith, that could be disturbing. And you know, they needed to address that for sure. But yeah, this isn't the first time that this issue has been discussed, and it won't be the last time that it's been discussed here in our timeline. And I get somewhat the impression that Paul is a little irritated he has to deal with this because he already gave them the gospel in its true form. He had shown them the grace of God, and you know, they had happily been converted. And then what we saw in chapter 1, where he says, "I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ." He's like, "You've got to be kidding me. Why are you?" I mean, that would be like, you know, if you went and converted a group of people in a nearby town, and then you heard not long after that, you know, they joined themselves to a denomination, that they became, you know, Lutherans not long after. You go, why? What made you leave? Why have you so suddenly changed and modified the grace of God that we taught you? That's what Paul is concerned with here. And so he's rebuking them to a degree, but then even more, he's rebuking the Judaizing teachers who ought not to be teaching thus. So there's a difference between the different apostles here, just in their purpose and the main goal that they had, the main work that they pursued. Paul was considered the apostle to the Gentiles, and we can make too much of that if we're not careful. He taught Jews plenty of times. When he went into different cities, if there was a synagogue, that was almost always his first stop. He went to the synagogue to try to teach them, to try to get the base of people who already knew who God was. And that seems like a very logical thing to do, because there's already a step that you don't have to take of convincing them that there's only one true God. The Jews, in theory, should believe that. In practice, what happened a lot was it was just as hard to convince them to abandon their traditions as it was to convince the Gentiles to abandon their pagan gods. Maybe harder to get the Jews to do that. And sometimes we find that as well, even today, slightly differently, but sometimes it's hard to convince people to leave their traditions, their denominations, their own religious ideas that they've built up. And when you're teaching somebody who just doesn't know really anything about religion, that can kind of be easier. So Paul did teach Jews plenty of times, but he was often called the apostle of the Gentiles because he spent a lot of time preaching to them. And he went to far-flung places where a lot of times there were no synagogues. If there were any Jews there, they were meeting in some little pavilion or meeting just under a tree by the river. There were only a few there. But a lot of times there were no Jews at all. And so he would go to cities that were entirely Gentile, entirely given over to paganism, and would start teaching them about the one true God. Think about him going to Athens, where he sees all of these idols built up, and even one to the unknown God, and he starts talking to them about the God that they have been worshiping unknowingly, and trying to show them who he really is and why he is the only one who's actually real and the one who deserves their worship. So that is a very important work. But it's not the only important work that needed to be done in the church. The pillars of the church in Jerusalem, Peter, James, and John, they didn't really travel to the same degree that Paul did. For the most part, they stayed in Jerusalem or in that area very nearby, and they worked with the church there. Now, which one is more important? I mean, it's just two different things. You know, Acts is devoted, a large portion of the book of Acts anyway, is devoted to following Paul. And so many of the letters in the New Testament were written by Paul because he dealt with so many different churches that we can have letters going to different people with very different problems versus the church of Jerusalem, which, you know, just has its own, I mean, not that they didn't have problems there, of course they did, but that's one timeline instead of all these different churches that can have their own issues. And so Paul gets this very prominent place in the New Testament, prominent place in history. We think of Paul as being, you know, either the most prominent apostle or maybe the second most, depending on your view of Peter. But he's right up there. Yet Paul is not really trying to elevate himself over the other apostles or saying that the work that they were doing wasn't important. It was just a different purpose. They were staying in Jerusalem. They worked steadily with the church there, with the Christians there. And that is important too. And we see that same kind of thing in the church today, that there are some people who stay in one place a long time. We can look around in this congregation, and some of you who have been here your entire lives, you've never lived anywhere but Del Rio, or almost your entire life has been here. Maybe this is the only church you've ever been a member of. Maybe your family has been here for more than one generation. That is a wonderful thing. And then you have some people who move around from place to place. And they, you know, because of the nature of their job or their life, for whatever reason, they're not somewhere any more than a few years. And the church needs both. It really does. Because both can bring some fresh insights, both can serve different purposes. My dad, he moved around with his job, and so we lived in different places. You know, now I'm a preacher, and preachers traditionally end up moving more than some people do, although I'm glad to have been here already for 5 years. And that's, I think, a really nice stretch of time to be able to be in one place. It is. But the point being is that neither one of those is better or worse. They're just different. And so those of you who have roots in this community going back decades or going back generations, there's some incredible value there. Some of you in this room, you know everybody in town. I'm not sure if there's somebody in town you don't know. And it just seems that way when I'm with you, that you see people you know everywhere you go. And I've never lived in a place where that happened for me, because I've never been somewhere long enough for that to happen. But I also have maybe some more experience with different churches, with the good practices and the bad practices in different places, can warn about some things or bring in some ideas that are helpful, some practices that have been helpful in other places. Both are useful. There are some people who have done far more traveling than I have. I don't mean to say I'm on that extreme, completely on that extreme. There are people who go and preach all over the world, or who move all over the world for different reasons. I may have an even different insight than I do, making me look like a homebody there when they've been everywhere. There's a place in the church for all of those life experiences. They all bring kind of a different perspective on the matter, and that's okay. And so when Paul got together with the pillars of a church in Jerusalem, it was not a competition where they were trying to decide who was the most accomplished apostle. They were discussing their experiences, the differences in what they did. They realized that Paul was set for, you know, being the apostle to the Gentiles, and Paul realized that they were set for being the apostles to the Jews. And I'm sure both of them dealt with people from both categories, but you know the general trends that I'm talking about. And they were fine with it. They were happy with it. There's no issue there. Paul describes that really as being different ministries that they're entrusted with.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, yeah, and you can, there's lots of divisions you can do this with, not just in the traveling or staying, but lots of divisions like that where there can be strengths or weaknesses with what kind of work you do. And I don't know that anyone ever reaches an extreme where you only ever do one thing and never anything else in your entire life, but we have tendencies. We have things that we gravitate to, things that we're better at. Part of the struggle for us is trying to grow outside of our comfort zone, to get those things that maybe don't come as easily to us, and to try it anyway. But it is also okay to use your strengths. That's one of the great reasons why we all have different strengths. Emba Church is made up of different people who have different gifts and abilities. That's true among preachers too, yes. So the point of the visit was for Paul and these apostles in Jerusalem to discuss the problem of Judaizing teachers, which is kind of ironic, actually, because the Judaizers were trying to use that visit as part of their argument that they were on Paul's side and that the Gentiles needed to listen to them. They were saying, look, Paul went to Jerusalem, he reported back to the apostles there in Jerusalem, and they gave him his marching orders, and they gave us our marching orders too, and so you need to be circumcised, you need to follow all of these traditions from Jewish law. The reality was that they were actually discussing the danger of those Judaizing teachers. And I do find that ironic. But that is how it works out a lot of times. That a lot of times the arguments that false teachers try to use, if you pick it apart, actually are some of the best proofs we have against them. But they try to use things. I see it all the time with the Bible verses, the passages that false teachers use to defend their arguments. A lot of times, if you will actually read that passage and read a little bit around it, you find that it's not talking about that at all. That if anything, it's talking about the opposite of that, and you can refute their own arguments from their own passages. In this case, they weren't referring to a Bible verse, to a scripture reference, but the event that they were referring to was actually the apostles getting together and discussing how do we combat the danger of these Judaizing false teachers. And so Paul says that they did not yield to these false brethren, even for a moment. Their message might sound well-intentioned. It might sound like they were just trying to help the Gentiles out and show them what they needed to do. But they were actually enslaving the Gentiles to a different gospel, and they were tainting the truth. And so Paul does not condone that in the least. All right, any comments on this section before we go on? Okay, so verses 11 through 14. Galatians 2, 11 through 14. But when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles, but when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing a circumcision party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? Now, this is where Paul's argument gets complicated. Not because the argument itself is complicated, but because Peter's sin has complicated the issue. And unfortunately, this is something that can happen quite a lot. Paul has been explaining over and over how he's not reporting to Jerusalem or to the apostles there in Jerusalem. He's not having to answer to them. But he's also not against them. And in fact, they are all on the same page, all doing the same thing. and they're all against the Judaizers. But there's one event that calls a lot of that into question. And I'm sure the Judaizers were jumping all over this to be able to show that Peter actually approved of what they were teaching. And this is kind of what sin does. So there's this one occasion where Peter gave in to pressure from the Judaizers. Peter came to Antioch one day, and he was meeting the Christians there, the Gentile Christians there. And he would eat with them, he would associate with them on equal terms, because he knew that now in the church there is no difference between Jew and Greek. There's no issue here. They don't have to be bound to Jewish law, and they're not anything lesser. We can all be there together with no problem. But then some Judaizers from Jerusalem also came into town, and suddenly everything changed. Peter went back for a moment to his old ways. He gave in to that pressure from the Judaizers, and he withdrew himself from associating with the Gentiles. He wouldn't eat with them, and he bound himself to the same standard that the Judaizers were trying to bind everyone to. Now, Peter, of course, had a very powerful influence because he's an apostle. He was a wise man. He was a Christian who had accomplished great things for the church. And so the rest of the Jewish Christians there in Antioch joined him in this. Even Barnabas joined him in this. And if you can get Barnabas to not be encouraging and not be helpful, then you have really messed up. And so Paul's there. And seeing all this happen, and with all the work that Paul's been doing to bring Gentiles into the church, to show them that they can be saved too, to show them that there's no difference between Jew and Gentile, now Peter is undoing all of this. And Paul does not take Peter aside privately to discuss the matter. He rebukes him publicly in front of everybody. And he was not wrong for doing so. I've seen people get upset before that when they say something publicly, when they sin blatantly and openly where lots of people see, that anyone would then dare talk about it. The things that you do out in public are subject to public discussion. Now, not saying that you can't talk to somebody privately about something, but if I teach you false doctrine here from this pulpit, I don't have any right to expect that none of you are allowed to talk about it amongst yourselves, or none of you can address, you know, that problem anywhere else, saying, well, this was a private thing with just me. It's not private. I taught it publicly. And so, yes, you do need to talk to me about it. I don't want you to let me continue going on teaching false doctrine, but you can challenge it publicly, and there's nothing wrong with that. Discretion and judgment are going to help in knowing the way that you approach a problem. The right answer still might be to talk about something privately first. But if something is bad enough, if something is so blatantly sinful, we don't have to have a private discussion about it first. If I stand up here blaspheming God, you can stand up and rebuke me. You don't have to pull me aside into the back room first. Peter made a terrible, terrible judgment here, a terrible decision that undid a lot of work that others were doing and called into question the faith of many Gentiles. And so Paul rebuked him publicly, saying, you know, you are a Jew, but you don't live by Jewish law anymore. Your salvation hasn't come through that, so why are you then requiring the Gentiles to do something more? And that actually brings up something else here that shows us that the problem was a little worse than Peter just not eating with the Gentiles. This is something that's overlooked a lot, I think. Look at what Paul's rebuke actually said. He says, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? That doesn't really sound like what Peter was doing. He wasn't forcing the Gentiles to do anything. He just withdrew himself. So we're left with two things. Either Paul is exaggerating his rebuke, which would make it a lot less useful, or there's even more to this story than what Paul actually mentions here. I think what is more likely is that Peter not just withdrew himself from the Gentiles and ate only with the Jews, but that he started to join in with the Judaizing teachers in saying, you Gentiles need to be circumcised. You Gentiles need to follow Jewish law, need to follow the traditions of our ancestors. And that's a very, very serious problem. I don't see how Paul would exaggerate his rebuke and make it worse than it actually was. I think Peter was going full on into this false doctrine, into this false teaching. And so, of course, Paul rebukes him for that. This is a gross misstep on Peter's part. This had to set back the discussion and the relationship between Jews and Gentiles immeasurably.
Well, he talks here, he addresses it in such a way it's hypocrisy.
Yeah, it is hypocrisy.
That's the biggest thing that you see here is Paul has always put a firm on separating or understanding.
Oh, yeah.
So
oh, yeah. Romans is great for that. Yeah. Unity comes from us all, you know, not just agreeing to disagree, but which is what a lot of people make it out to be, and I've never understood that. That is not unity at all. Unity is when we all hold ourselves to the same standard that God holds us to. That is the only way you're ever going to get a group of people to be in complete unity, because if it's on what we think on the matter, it doesn't. It's hard enough to get, you know, a family in unity, a marriage in unity, much less a congregation or any group bigger than one person. You just have to add, you know, that second person before you start to get some disagreements and some tension on different issues. And so, yeah, there are all sorts of different doctrines, things like the social gospel that you're talking about with the kind of recreation that is getting put into the church, diluting the message of the church from the power of God to save down to let's have a good time. That is a very appealing thing for people to want to do, because who doesn't like to have fun? But it cheapens the work of a church to reduce us down to just recreation. Honestly, brethren, the world does not lack for opportunities for recreation. I mean, there's plenty of stuff you can do for fun that the church doesn't have to add to that when, you know, what we have much more important work to do. And that doesn't mean I have any problem with recreation. It just means that's not the function of the church. And so there's a lot of issues where teaching false doctrine or the sin of different people can create a lot of headaches, can set things back, and can create more obstacles in convincing people to leave the church or to never join in the first place. Elizabeth? Yes. Absolutely. The way of a man is not within himself. That, you know, we can be convinced that all sorts of things are good ideas. That doesn't make them good ideas. And we can have a lot of contradictory ideas. Something that you think is the absolute best thing to do, and I think the complete opposite. Well, if we both earnestly and sincerely believe it, who's right? Well, maybe neither one of us. That is really not important what we think. It's what Christ has told us to do. And so one thing that Peter's example shows us here is that the sin of a Christian can create a lot of problems. And this is another reason why I think it's very plausible that this issue of the Judaizing teachers went on as long as it did. I think Peter set them back a whole lot here. This happened sometime before Paul, you know, actually came to Jerusalem, but you know, this was part of the reason why they continued to have to address it. And thankfully, by the time they had their very big public gathering about it in Acts 15, Peter had his act together and figured out what he was really going to do, and he takes a very prominent role there, not in telling everybody what to do, but in showing, you know, almost without having to completely say it, but by saying, you know, I was wrong before. This is what God wants us to do. And Peter very firmly shows that the Gentiles do not have to follow Jewish law. And so that's good that he figured that out. And honestly, if you have taught false doctrine in the past, or your sin has been a negative influence, then you do bear some responsibility to help fight against that once you know better, because you do some damage with your influence, and you can make some good out of that by showing, hey, I was one of the ones who fell into this, and it was utterly and completely wrong, and here's how to do better. This complicates everything. Paul's having to address this. He's having to show that Peter was wrong here, and he's showing that he was not unwilling to rebuke Peter for it. And the Gentiles needed to not be worried that there was this disagreement. So remember that your Christians can do great damage with their sin. Which gives us strong reason not to sin in the first place. You know, sometimes we think, well, I can always be forgiven. I can always ask for forgiveness and it all goes away. Okay, but there can still be consequences to our poor choices. Okay, so next week, Jesse is going to be here. So he's going to be teaching class and doing the morning lesson. So we'll be taking a break from this. We may quickly talk about this last section here, verses 15 through 21, the week after. But next week I'll bring the next lesson too, so you can start working on that. Thanks.